This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. The music tonight, our introduction, was the theme from Armageddon. We approach tonight's topic with some reservations, given all that's happened in the county in the past weeks, the past 2 years and beyond.
We've heard and read people saying we should have known about a number of crises, including global warming, forest thinning, the economy, the plague.
Tonight's program is a replay of an interview we recorded a couple of years ago with Dmitry Orlov. He's author of a book called The Five Stages of Collapse, A Survivor's Toolkit. His stages focus first on economic collapse, which in some ways is what we are experiencing through COVID-19.
But his concerns apply equally well and include environmental collapse. And spoiler alert, he foresees a grim future for humankind. We'll play that interview in a moment.
And we'll also follow it with something a little bit more positive. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Corona Conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets on Wednesday mornings at the North Valley Plaza and on Saturday mornings at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico. The Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. The opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, volunteers, underwriters, or programmers. Here's our interview with Dmitry Orlov.
No.
Hang on, folks. Minor technical difficulties. We'll be here with the interview in just a moment.
I can't see this.
We're looking to find the right track on the tape. We need to go to number 2.
There we go.
Okay. This is Ecotopia on KZFR with your hosts, Susan and Stephen Chute. Our guest on the phone tonight is Dmitry Orlov. He's author of a book from New Society Publishers titled The Five Stages of Collapse, Survivor's Handbook. Dmitry has had careers in physics, e-commerce, and internet security. He's studied linguistics, but in recent years he's been particularly interested in studying how societies collapse. His interest started with the Soviet Union, from which he and his family emigrated in the 1970s, but has now expanded to the U.S., numerous other countries around the globe, and in fact, the globe itself. Welcome, Dmitry Orlov.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your program.
Dmitry, you begin your book by saying collapse is a socially awkward subject. Perhaps we could begin by having you define collapse and talk about why people are reluctant to acknowledge and discuss it.
Well, there are two prevalent myths in Western society. There's the myth of progress, of endless economic growth and so on. And then the flip side of that is the myth of the apocalypse, of sudden collapse, Earth getting hit by an asteroid or a plague or something like that. So those are basically the narratives that are allowed. Collapse is rather a different subject because, it sounds cataclysmic, and it can be, but really it is a narrative of steady degradation of various things that people are used to perceiving as very important becoming irrelevant. So to me, collapse is an umbrella term for a number of different events that are profoundly reality-altering. We all live in this bubble called consensual reality. It's a term from psychology. Basically, we all agree on what is real, what is not because of something we observe or know. It's just something that is an agreed upon thing, an artifice. So, for instance, we believe that the U.S. dollar has value. That is not something that is physical, it's mental.
Right.
Now, collapse may affect entire economies or countries or just certain communities or groups or just certain families, certain individuals. It happens at very low scale, small scale at first. But the similarity to me is that there's always a breach of trust, trust in markets and governments and in financial institutions, in one's fellow creatures. And trust is a most precious commodity and very scarce. Mm-hmm. And it is something that builds up over time, slowly and painfully, but can be lost almost instantaneously. And a contemporary example of trust that has been broken is, you know, for instance, the idea that a college degree will get you a well-paying job, mm-hmm. or actually any kind of job. So we have 50% of recent college grads that don't have the jobs they trained for, and another third work in jobs that require a college degree, but not the one that's specific to the field. And another example is retirees that have worked for decades and put money into Social Security and municipal retirement schemes and 401k accounts and so forth, and are now looking at a destitute old age in spite of that, because those accounts are either empty, they've been looted, or they've been invested in financial instruments that are basically synthetic Wall Street garbage. So these are the sorts of collapses that we're living through right now that we can see, we can agree upon, that are ongoing. And so this is not something that I'm projecting into the future. This is something that's here and now.
That's happening. You talk about five stages of collapse, and you start with economic, commercial, and political, which we'll talk about in the first half of the show, and then we'll talk about social and cultural. Is that the progress of collapse? So does it start with economic collapse, or is this progressive? Is this paradigm a progressive paradigm?
Well, basically, collapse is sort of baked into the scheme of the sort of economic growth that we've been having, which is basically fueled by fossil fuels and various types of non-renewable resources, which are now largely depleted. So if you look at just the government statistics that the U.S. government produces on non-renewable resources of all kinds, you know, it's pretty easy to see that it mostly comes down to non-renewable resource scarcity. And if you add to that environmental devastation, including runaway climate change, then the picture becomes complete. The economic model that we have relies on more or less constant growth. Recessions happen, but they must be temporary. Otherwise, all the pyramid of debt goes bad, and there's a gigantic crash. So in 2005, global conventional oil peaked. A couple of years later, there was a historical oil spike up to about $150 a barrel, and that crashed the economy and triggered the Great Recession. There has been no real recovery since then, and Western economies are floating on an ever greater ocean of red ink, just unrepayable debt through endless borrowing and money printing. This cannot go on forever. Meanwhile, the energy industry has gone after the dregs, such as fracking oil shale, digging out tar sands, drilling in deep offshore oil fields. This keeps oil production from dropping, but the resulting oil is too expensive to allow for economic growth. It chokes growth. There has also been investment in renewables, such as wind farms, to generate electricity. But that, if you look at the statistics, is really just a drop in the bucket. It amounts to nothing. The industrial economy runs on coal, oil, and natural gas. Meanwhile, just about every other natural resource, from timber to iron ore, is of ever lower quality and in harder to reach places. The only non-renewable resource that is plentiful, according to the U.S. government, is bauxite for aluminum smelting. That is it.
Mm. Dmitry Orlov, I remember in elementary school 55 years ago being taught that America was great because we had a gold bar at Fort Knox for every dollar we printed. And it was likened to people worried about Germany and after World War II, where people were carting around wheelbarrows full of printed money that had no backing. You write extensively about that in your chapter on economics, and you've mentioned printing money. How does that fit into the economic collapse and schemes to prop it up?
Well, basically, the U.S. outgrew the gold hoard even when it had it, relied on something called the petrodollar to kind of make its way in the world. take advantage of the world having largest oil production capacity of any country, and that ended in 1970. That was when U.S. oil production peaked for all time. It has been declining steadily, with just a few tiny blips of recovery ever since then. And so that was basically when the run on the gold started, and when Nixon shut down the gold window, the dollar went off the gold standard and has been inflating ever since. It lost something like 98% of its value since then. And now money printing is the only thing that is sustaining the U.S. government, the only thing that is preventing government shutdown. About a third of the money that the U.S. government spent is printed. It's just basically printed into existence. So that is not really something that can go on forever. Nobody knows when it's going to end, but what is known is that it ends suddenly. All of these experiments end very suddenly.
So do you think there's going to be a specific event that tips us over the edge? I mean, what are you, when you're imagining what this collapse is going to be like? Because it feels, as you said a few minutes ago, we're in collapse. So what's going to be the thing that makes us all know that? Maybe that's, or panics people, or, you know, what's going to happen with this, Mr. Seer into the future?
Well, it really depends on who you are. You see, there will be people that are, you know, you might consider them insane, but they will forever deny that there is such a thing as collapse. They will always say that, oh, this sort of thing has happened before, this is just business as usual, etc. You know, after the Soviet Union collapsed 10 years later, there were still people out on the streets parading around with portraits of Lenin and Stalin, begging for the Soviet Union to be brought back. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that there will be people parading around with portraits of, I don't know, Ronald Reagan, hoping for the United States to be brought back. And, you know, that is perfectly normal. So you have to always look at the minority of people who are actually capable of thinking for themselves to figure out, you know, what is actually going on.
How will people's survival be affected by as the collapse goes on? Already you describe people not being able to get jobs, that people are trained for jobs that aren't available, or they're working in jobs, but we continue to have problems with unemployment. Will that increase? What will the collapse continue to look like, and how will people manage it or survive it?
Well, basically, in a lot of places, not everywhere at once, but in a lot of places, people will lose access to various key resources. The only gas station that's open is like half a tank of gas away. You know, that's your typical problem where you can no longer move, where you, after that point, you're stranded. Or the one Walmart that you can actually afford to drive to closes, and of course that Walmart has destroyed the entire retail chain in the area. Mm-hmm. So once it goes away, then there's nothing left. So that's kind of how it dwindles around the periphery. And then there can be major disruptions and effects, knock-on effects that cause the lights to go out. And then if you have a blackout for longer than 2 weeks, then it's really hard to bring back what was there before. A lot of things deteriorate to a point where you are left with a lot of broken infrastructure that cannot recover.
Mm-hmm. And you describe this as cascaded failure, where we see the commercial structure falls apart after the economic collapse, and then followed by failure of the political structure. I wonder if you could give us a little picture of these phases, particularly the political.
Sure. So the general sequence goes like this. The financial house of cards finally collapses, like it almost did in 2008, except no bailout scheme this time is likely to save it, because those magic bullets have already been shot. When commercial banks stop operating, then letters of credit can no longer be honored, and cargoes can no longer be loaded onto ships, and global supply chains for everything from oil to plastic orange Halloween pumpkins breaks down. And what happens next after that is trust between international trading partners disappears, and trading networks break down too. And from there, it's just a couple of weeks to empty shelves and stores everywhere, almost everywhere, and a couple of months before lights go out just about everywhere. So after that, it's a very, very different world. Now, when commerce stops, people can no longer work. People lose their jobs. The tax base and the tax receipts for government at every level pretty much goes down to zero, which means that government ceases operation, stops mm-hmm. operating. And if you have to keep in mind that everything, including private property, including free markets, these are all government schemes. Without a government, they don't exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you give the case study of Iceland, the collapse of the economy in Iceland. And we were planning to visit there, and the economy collapsed, and we didn't know what to expect. But so what happened in Iceland, and can that provide a model for us?
Well, you have to understand that Iceland is basically a country that's the size of a small to middling town. Mm-hmm. And it's also an ancient democracy. So there's something that they can achieve democratically that larger democracies, okay. representative democracies, cannot. The Icelanders, because they know each other, they're all one tribe, they are invested with a greater degree of sovereignty than the citizens of large countries, which are basically sovereign dwarves, if you think about it. Now, Iceland is interesting because they bucked the trend. When their banks imploded, instead of turning the private debts that these banks accumulated into public debts, which would have been completely impossible,
mm-hmm.
They shut down the banks. They eventually paid back the depositors, but not the various mm-hmm. investors, and they allowed the banks to fail, and that's what saved them. But nevertheless, Iceland is very, very heavily indebted. In the future, I think, its future is not particularly bright.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that was very interesting to me about the experience in Iceland is that there was an economic recovery there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that contributed to that economic recovery is that they shut down all of these financial institutions. And the people who worked in those institutions, the engineers and the mathematicians and the computer programmers and the technicians of various kind, they went to work in the productive economy and produced actual good economic results, because basically the entire financial sector is a giant leech on the economy. They move money from pocket to pocket and pocket mm-hmm. some of it themselves, but they don't actually produce anything of value.
You've also talked about gifting as a response to the commercial and economic class collapse. Could you talk about how that works?
Well, gifting is really just the bedrock of human society. It's how families operate. When children eat candy, we don't invoice them for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's how families operate. That's how small tribes operate. It's basically people do whatever they can for each other, because the more they do for each other, the higher status they are as individuals within their little society.
Yeah.
So it's actually the opposite of how, say, a market economy operates, because in a market economy, your status is higher depending on how much you get.
Mm-hmm.
In a gift economy, your status depends on how much you can afford to give away.
But you also remarked about particularly charitable institutions giving things away to people who are less fortunate than they are. And you had some negative things to say about that kind of gifting, that it produces dependence and eventually hostility to the giver.
Yes, well, that's not true gift. A true gift has within it an element of reciprocity. You get a really funny reaction if some very rich person, you know, gives you something as a charitable contribution, and you turn around and you know, either decline it because you tell them that, well, you couldn't possibly repay it, or you even make a promise to repay them. That would be a very awkward moment.
Mm-hmm.
But any sort of gift that is by definition non-repayable, or you know, that does not have an element of reciprocity to it, is basically an insult.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it morphs from being a gift to being a demand.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even see it with animals. If you start feeding a wild animal, for instance, it's not going to be grateful. It's going to be ever more demanding of you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it works with charity as well. So mm-hmm. if somebody gives you something out of charity, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's an insult. And the way you get out of that insult is by subverting charity into something else. So you sell whatever it is at a profit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would be a good way to counter. Or you try to get as much as you can, much more than you need, and then you try to give some of it away, because then that'll raise your status within the community.
So do you think that people in the face of collapse, if there's a commercial collapse and food isn't readily available, do you think that their worst natures will come forth, or will their best natures come forth, or is that just an individual, or will it become, you know, people just fighting for the whatever scraps?
Well, I think that there will be all of the above. It'll become very unpredictable. The social environment will become very unpredictable, because a great number of people, you know, they are very alienated, and they play by the rules that they've been told, that they've been, they just basically play the roles they've been assigned. If those roles disappear, if their environment no longer makes sense, then they no longer know who they are, and nobody knows what to expect of them. And then there are other people who are really, you know, they do have some sense of community. They have strong friendships, and they have networks of personal trust that they are part of. And if there's enough of that, then you can actually have something that is relatively peaceful and helpful and reasonable emerge as a result of this. But I think the overall background will be this profound loss of self, you know, that people will experience, because their self is defined by their spending ability.
Oh, wow. Interesting. And law and order, you say, as the political sector of the culture collapses, we'll have the end of law and order, we'll have anarchy. Is that bad, or will it give people opportunities for a new way of governing?
Well, the situation is right now is that, you know, we have more laws than anybody knows, really, mm-hmm. not even the lawyers. It's been estimated that the average American unwittingly commits an average of 3 felonies per day.
My goodness. I wonder what mine are.
Well, most people don't know, but if you actually very carefully look at the laws, it's just the fact that prosecutors don't go after people, because there's still this idea that you have to be conscious that you're committing a crime in order for it to be a crime. Mm. Otherwise, it's a mistake. But it's not actually working out that way in a lot of cases, so a lot of people are getting sentenced for crimes they didn't know they were committing. A lot of silly ones, because we basically have too many laws, mm-hmm. too many lawyers and too many laws. So all of that is very expensive, and, you know, we have gigantic prison population that, you know, Attorney General Holder now says is unsustainable. He made
yes.
a speech about that
mm-hmm.
just the other day.
Yesterday, I think, yeah.
So the writing, you know, the writing is on the wall for this entire system. Now, when all of these laws become unenforceable, the question is, what happens? So one way to go is anarchy, and that's pretty bad. And a lot of people think that it's pretty bad. But what anarchy really is lack of hierarchy.
Uh-huh.
So if you have lack of hierarchy, there's really no subordination to any given individual, but it doesn't mean that there isn't subordination to the group.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
what you need in order for a hierarchy to become superfluous and unnecessary and self-governance to evolve is to have relatively tight-knit groups that have some decision-making ability, usually by consensus,
mm-hmm.
and decide what goes and decide who to include and who to exclude.
Mm-hmm.
And then anarchy can actually be quite reasonable and peaceful and safe.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR Radio in Chico, serving the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. We're talking with Dmitry Orlov about his book, The Five Stages of Collapse, Survivor's Toolkit. We'll take a brief break and then come back to ask Dmitry about the last two stages of collapse, social and cultural.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR in Chico, and we're talking with Dmitry Orlov. He's the author of The Five Stages of Collapse, recently published by New Society Publishers. And we're going to talk about we've been talking about the five stages of collapse: economic, commercial, political, social, and cultural. But we want to focus just a little bit more on social and cultural collapse. What do these look like, Dmitry Orlov?
Well, basically, I separated them into what people can do for each other as communities, which is, if they can't, then that's their social collapse, if there's nothing they can do for each other, and what they can do for each other as families and even smaller groups, and that is cultural collapse, because the final repository of culture is the family. It's how people interact face-to-face. People who are related. So I looked at those two, and I looked at how societies function or fail to function once finance, commerce, and government go away. And I looked at a number of examples of societies that basically shun all government interference or as much of it as possible and nevertheless hold together for long periods of time. And I've also looked at societies where it all failed, so that there was really no social structure of any form, no social institutions, no trust, and also very weak, borderline non-existent and largely irrelevant families. And compared that to what's going on in developed countries in the West and in the United States.
In the chapter on social collapse, you describe how an enlightened, well-meaning group of people might attempt to construct a safe place in which to ride out social collapse. And your description struck us as sounding a lot like Chico, California, with community planning, family gardens, farmer markets, bike lanes, an environmental ethic in the government concerning energy consumption, waste disposal, renewable energy. But you also say in that chapter that may not be protection enough, or that may not work out particularly well. Why not?
Well, California is not just Chico, and the United States is not just California. And just in California, you also have Bakersfield and places like that. Hellholes, basically. And after government security and other services go away, it won't take long for society to become substantially randomized. So you'll have a little bit of Chico inside Bakersfield and a lot of Bakersfield inside Chico suddenly turning up. And you won't quite know one from the other. But I think that all of these enlightened approaches, everything that you mentioned, the farmers markets, the bike lanes, a little bit of renewable energy, I'm sure people in Chico drive cars that's not on gasoline, just like everywhere else, wouldn't know what to do, wouldn't be able to get to their jobs without those cars. Most of them. They also shop at big box stores, just like everywhere else. And once those stores close, you know, that'll be a big disruption. It may be all green and friendly, but they still probably cook with natural gas or electricity. So it's all little things that basically make people feel better about who they are. And all of these enlightened approaches, if you really look at them, are basically middle-class hobbies that tend to raise real estate values. And real estate, private property in general, is something, it's an artificial construct safeguarded by the government. Private property is a government scheme, just like free markets are a government scheme. And you know, you have to keep in mind that, you know, American middle class is not something that's holding up spectacularly right now. And as it dwindles, I think these middle class hobbies around sustainability and all sorts of progressivism will dwindle as well, because, you know, necessity drives people to the simplest, cheapest, most basic solution that will work today. Not something that is, you know, is planned for or, you know, is put together in some kind of a cooperative style. Everybody tries to do whatever they need that very day. And so community planning and things like that, planning of all sorts, just basically goes away. The planning horizon shrinks down to that day or maybe that week. And that is really what people should expect.
What does the Survivor's Toolkit include for this kind of social collapse? And we're saying touche on these points about what places like Chico can do. But what are some of the alternatives that people might pursue in the coming years?
It really depends on who they are. Basically, the groups that stand the largest chance are the ones that have a sense of group loyalty and honor in standing up for each other. And the people who will fare the worst are the pseudo-rugged individuals who are actually abjectly dependent on finance and commerce and government services. So those communities that have strong family ties, strong extended families, some kind of loyalty to the group, they will fare the best. And I can give you one example. The Mormons will do pretty well because it's the Bishop's Warehouse and because it is not optional for them to come to each other's aid. And there are many groups like that. They're not huge, but there's a sizable percentage of the population in the United States that basically has a completely different mindset, mentality from the general population that will allow them to make it.
You also mentioned religion as an organizing principle following social collapse. Could you please describe how that might work?
Well, the fact is that, you know, in the United States, there are a lot of laws that limit what you can do reasonably to become self-sufficient as a group. Because basically, you know, authorities hate things they can't tax. And if a group suddenly starts providing everything it needs internally, then there's no room for the tax man to go in and tax incomes, etc. And so they hate that, and they try to dismantle it whenever they see it. The only exception that exists is for religious communities of various kinds. I was recently at a conference, and there were a couple of people there who run various kinds of intentional communities. There was Albert Bates there, who ran the farm, and for a long time, and some other people as well. And the commonality that we found is that these communities are best if there are, first of all, religious communities, secondly, historical preservation societies, thirdly, some kind of nature preserve. That allows you to cover all the bases and get every single legal exception you can. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where if you collect all three, like bingo, you win, intentional community bingo by doing that.
Yeah, a lot of there are a few intentional communities in our area, and a lot of the value there is, yes, and not ever going to big box stores, and in bartering, in passing things along, in making their own food. And there's an organization that's forming for making clothing getting people to grow things like flax and to grow dyes. So there are efforts that you see that are working toward this total self-sufficiency, but it's really hard to imagine total self-sufficiency. There's an intentional community in Mendocino County that tried to eat within a 100-mile radius, and this is in California. A 100-mile radius in California can get you a lot of food, and they found it difficult. And so even those communities that are working on trying to be self-sustaining and trying to work together to provide for needs, it's a stretch.
Well, I used to have this idea that one thing you could do to make collapse sort of interesting and palatable to more people is to make it all about delicious food. So it's like again three elements, all kinds of collapse and then environmental devastation and near term human extinction and delicious produce.
And, I love it.
That's like the idea for a website. So if you don't want like near-term human extinction, you can talk about tomatoes. And that's what would make it work. And the thing is that, none of it really has to do with survival because, the people who ate everything within a 100-mile radius drove within that radius. So that's not exactly, sustainable anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it had to get to them within 100 miles.
Yeah, and I bet they were all foodies anyway. I bet that they were all into, finding delicious things to eat within a 100-mile radius. But the thing is that if you want to survive, right, you need a few things. You need potatoes. Mm-hmm. You could just eat potatoes. Mm-hmm. Or you could have a mix of things, like you could have rye, turnips, those two, and cabbage, yeah. So you can have a diet that consists of cabbage, turnips, and rye.
Okay.
And that would be sustainable.
Right, right.
And you would have, less than a quarter of an acre per family, probably, mm-hmm. is enough.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, and that's survivable. But nobody's ever going to try that unless they have to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Dmitry Orlov, you have several fascinating case studies in the book, including the Russian mafia. I wanted to ask you about the case study for social collapse, the Roma people.
Yes, well, the Roma, or the gypsies as they're known, they're a very interesting, very large tribe or collection mm-hmm. of tribes. They're, mm-hmm. not really organized beyond a clan. They have clan level self-governance. But they're very interesting. There's something between 12 and 15 million of them around the world, so they're quite numerous. They're one of the bigger ethnic groups. And they've been around for at least 1,000 years. And during this time, they have been largely separatist. They don't interbreed or intermarry much with the surrounding population. And they're interesting in a lot of different ways. They're nomadic. They have very low regard for literacy, so they don't send their children to school. They think that literacy destroys memory. They have a very strong culture of their own that basically limits to interactions with non-Roma people to a minimum. They have a set of taboos that basically makes it very difficult for them to interact with people who are not Roma. But they have a lot of what seems like very old-fashioned ways of behaving within the group, but it's over the 1,000 or so years that they've been wandering the planet, their way of living, their lifestyle, or you know, their culture has been honed and perfected to a very high degree, which makes them very interesting.
And they'll do well in collapse.
Well, they actually do better in collapse than at other times. So they did rather badly during the Soviet Union. They did very, very badly during Nazi Germany. These were all very highly organized teams. But then when the Soviet Union collapsed, a lot of them actually managed to do quite well in the Russian Federation and in the Balkans, at least. They did less well in the Ukraine because there they lost the ability to be nomadic, to travel, because the borders were closed to them. And that is really the only thing that is a high risk to them, is if there is a weak but nevertheless disruptive government influence.
And the Roma people that I have experience with don't depend on technology, don't depend on power, don't depend on gasoline. Some had vehicles. This was in Romania. And some had large houses, but they didn't have electric power and running water. So they're not accustomed to that. And I mean, in this particular culture, they weren't accustomed to that.
Well, they try to keep things really basic. The nomadic ones, they really cultivate the ability to move on a moment's notice. That's how they avoid most difficult or dangerous situations, is by fleeing. Relocation is a very powerful technique to keep yourself safe. And being pinned to a certain place is probably the largest liability that anyone can have. The equivalent of keeping all your eggs in one basket. So, and if you travel, it's better to travel light. So they're minimalists.
Right.
The final stage of your book is cultural collapse, and it's a grim chapter. You talk, say, families disband, compete as individuals for scarce resources. The new motto becomes, may you die today so I can die tomorrow. Please explain this view, and especially what the the survivor's toolkit contains to help avoid that.
Well, I looked at this tribe called the Ik, an African, East African tribe that came pretty close to the verge of extinction. I think that the tribe has been disbanded at this point, but it was studied by an anthropologist who was absolutely shocked at the social devastation that he discovered. Because these people basically no longer had family. They no longer took care of old people. They no longer took care of children. They sent three-year-olds out to fend for themselves and, you know, pick half-eaten dates that the baboons would drop. There was absolutely no connection, real connection, between generations. So everybody hated their parents, basically. And these people were at the same time, you know, taking advantage of just about everything they could. The girls made as much money as they could for prostitution. They also stole whatever they could from neighboring tribes whenever they could. So they were very canny people at the same time, but very, very nasty. And what this anthropologist Colin Turnbull discovered is that you know, there's a basis for comparing these people to Westerners and to the state of Western society to a very large extent, because you know, this weak, virtually non-existent family. Well, look at the United States, highest divorce rate in the world, 1/3 of the children brought up without a father. estranged families where parents and children don't really interact. Everybody watches their own television set or plays with their own little electronic device, whatever it is. Common meal times are in most families that I see are thing of the past. You know, there isn't really much conversation. It all seems rather scripted and pro forma. So these people are not really going to take care of each other. And it's really sort of a dog-eat-dog world here already. You know, family structure has fallen apart. Americans largely act out of self-interest, and they consider anyone who acts differently to be a sucker or some sort of idealist or even subversive. And they're very much like the African tribe, the Ik, that I describe in the book. You know, the Ik are very Western in their orientation. Rugged individualists, entrepreneurial, hard-nosed businessmen. But because they don't have the cushy life of finance, commerce, and government services, which still provide some help to Western people, their life is absolute hell. And so to me, this is the picture of cultural collapse. No family, no tribal loyalty. And once the first three stages of collapse have run their course, you're left with nothing. And what happens is that people turn out not to be animals, that would be better. But they still have language and symbolic reasoning and memory and ability to communicate. They turn out to be much worse than animals.
So I have two questions. One is, how are you personally preparing for a collapse or living in collapse? And secondly, is this your vision of the future, the Ik? Is this what you personally see as the inevitable result of collapse in the West and in the United States in particular?
Well, to me, this is not really about me. It's about what I can do for other people. I don't know that I can help people prepare too much, but I can help them prepare psychologically, and that's already pretty important. I can try to bring to people's attention something that they might not otherwise think about at all, so that when these collapse-related events start affecting them, they don't make the mistake of thinking that it's their fault or that this is something that happens to them alone. And also they might entertain certain notions, such as you can actually survive by sharing, by giving gifts and receiving gifts from people you trust. You know, plant those seeds as well. So it's not really about what I do, but in terms of my personal life, I've downsized my existence a great deal, and we're living on a sailboat, and our possessions fit on that sailboat.
Nice.
And so that you know, cuts down both the expenses and the environmental footprint and everything at the same time. Plus, it's actually a very pleasant lifestyle most of the time. Mm-hmm. Depends on the weather. But
yeah,
most of the time, it's very pleasant.
Yes.
Thanks. We want to thank you very much for being with us tonight, Dmitry Orlov. The book is The Five Stages of Collapse, Survivor's Toolkit. We found it a fascinating book. It's challenging. It's also witty and fun, and sometimes in a black humor sort of way. But we loved reading it. Dmitry also has a blog that has some detailed suggestions for potential survivors. That's at cluborlov.blogspot.com. The book itself is published by New Society. And again, Dmitry, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
We appreciate it. Bye.
And again, that was our interview with Dmitry Orlov done a couple of years ago. A couple of things we asked Dmitry in a later interview, where can people go as the climate collapses? He suggested going to Siberia. He said the permafrost is going to thaw. There's going to be rich agricultural land in Siberia. He suggested loading up a backpack and heading off in that direction. We did run into a couple of articles and websites that we want to mention just briefly in the wake of Dmitry's pretty depressing and discouraging view of the future of the world. We just read over the weekend in the New York Times magazine an article by Abraham Lustgarten, who did an in-depth investigation of what's going to happen under climate change in this country. The title of his very long article and richly detailed how climate migration will shape America. Millions will be displaced. Where will they go? And it's a very discouraging description of what's going to happen. And it links up also with economic collapse, lack of food, the rising of the seas, and all those effects. And not encouraging. There are not a lot of places where people can go. Again, that's in the New York Times Magazine. We'll put up the link to that article on our website. On a more positive note, Californians for All has put out a website called Acts of Kindness in the Context of Wildfires. And it's Californians for All info at cvcal.gov. They have a number of suggestions, small ones to be sure. Talk to a neighbor, do a favor for a neighbor, make a meal for a neighbor, volunteer virtually, volunteer at a food bank, pantry delivery. They have a little game, it's a bingo game where you can fill in all those spots, helping out other people. And a number of people we've talked to on this program have said, and Dimitri voiced this as well, in the face of collapse and climate degradation, what we can do is be nice to each other, and not in a sappy, touchy-feely, Pollyannish way, but be genuinely helpful to others. With that in mind, here is a slightly upbeat tune, and in a melancholy kind of way.
So that's it for Ecotopia. Ginger Nichols is here, and she is going to be on in 2 minutes with Radioactive, where she plays lots of music for a long time. Next week?
We'll be talking with Jack Kiley, who, among other things, has tried to get the city of Oroville to buy out Cal Water. He's going to talk to us about water issues, including the Paradise Irrigation District proposal to pipe water down to Rideau that some of us pretty much, very much oppose.
Yes, and you've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs, plus an ever-growing list of resources provided by our guests, and we just learned that somebody was actually using them for school, so all of you should be doing that, especially those of you who are stuck at home and are looking to do some interesting things on the environment or social issues. You can also hear our programs on various podcasting sites, including Anchor, Spotify, Apple, and Google. We also welcome your comments and suggestions. Send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
You are the new day. You are the new day. I will love you more than me and more than yesterday. If you can but prove to me you are. Slow words and men.